Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. And today this is episode number 89. And we're going to talk about a book called Pavan by Keith Roberts. And this is an interesting book. I selected it. It's an interesting book because the view of the Catholic Church in this is less than stellar.
You're so polite.
Yeah, well. Anyway, what this book is, this is a book that's been on my list for years and years, because it's held up so often as a really beautiful example of a alternate history novel.
And I'd never heard of it.
Really?
Which is so
and
odd.
It was showing up on all kinds of lists and things. You know, whenever I would do that, I'd just come across this and I'm going, oh, I should read that. I should read that. I should read that. It's about, I don't know, 250 pages or so. And the premise of the novel, the prologue, there's a very short prologue, you know, and the first paragraph says, on a warm July evening of the year 1588, in the Royal Palace of Greenwich, London, a woman lay dying, an assassin's bullets lodged in the in abdomen and chest. Her face was lined, her teeth blackened, and death lent her no dignity, but her last breath started echoes that ran out to shake a hemisphere, for the fairy queen, Elizabeth I, paramount ruler of England, was no more. So, Elizabeth I gets assassinated there in the very first paragraph of the prologue. And the result of that is that the Reformation never takes place, or never gains traction.
It's started there, and it's been going in Germany, but
exactly
Philip II comes in, says, "Hey, they're pretty confused right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just take over." And as a loyal Catholic, he just sweeps through, and that gives the church impetus in other places to kind of overrun everybody, which at the very beginning I was like, really? Because I think like in Germany, they were danged entrenched, but okay.
You bet. So that's the premise of the novel. The Catholic Church that is in this novel is like a, from this Reformation period, you know, the problems that people had with the church, you know, things like the Inquisition and how, you know, the political power that the church had, you know, just in the last episode, we were talking a little bit about the Reformation in A Man for All Seasons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the political power of the church gets even stronger rather than, you know, having it retreat from political power to, you know, what it is today. It got even stronger. The grip got even stronger. And in the novel and somewhere it says that they, you know, half the world is under the grip of, they call it the church militant, which is really the political, you know, the Pope has armies and things like that.
Yeah. Which is really actually isn't the church militant in literal truth. It's just us here on Earth.
Right, right.
Because we have a chance to, through our actions, change things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the book starts in 1968.
So here we are, what, 400 years after the assassination of Elizabeth I. In 1968, I should say, the word Pavan means stately dance. It's a dance. And the book is actually, I guess you'd call it a fix-up novel, which is six stories that I believe that they all appeared in magazines, and they were collected here as this novel. And there's six stories, or six measures, they're called. First, you know, first one's called The First Measure, The Lady Margaret. So the first story is in 1968, And I can't remember when the last story is, but it's a couple generations after, I believe, or at least one generation.
I know, because I think a lot of the time they didn't put a date, did they?
And yeah, not all the time. I remember in
so
Brother John.
I was guessing a lot.
I remember Brother John, I noted that it said 1985.
Okay.
There was a letter or something that was signed, 1985.
By the time it got done, it was like close to now, not exactly, but mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like 1990s or 2000 or right. something like that.
And the book itself was written in right around 1968.
Yeah, I didn't love the book as much as you did. So the fact that I didn't realize until fairly late into it that it was a fix-up novel,
mm-hmm.
which term I don't think I've ever really noticed, and I love that. But that, for me, helped with some of the problems I had with the book. And for instance, the fact that practically every story started off with, oh, here we are, and let me just tell you how horrible the Catholic Church is in this way. And mm-hmm. by the time I got to the third one, I was like, I got it. Thank mm-hmm. you. So then I realized that he was having to set this world for every time the story went to a new magazine or something.
Right, right.
And the other thing that that helped with was that they didn't always seem to flow together, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when I went, oh, wait, this wasn't written actually as a book. So I kind of had to take that marker away from the author in terms of continuity. I mean, mm-hmm. and it wasn't that they weren't continuous. It's just that sometimes they just seem to flitter around here and there, and you kind of went, what does that have to do with what went before and after? Oh, it was written as a separate story. So
right, right.
That was helpful
and,
too.
Yeah, and the stories often contained people that were related.
Mm-hmm.
So the first story is called The Lady Margaret. It's about a guy who's a haulier. He hauls things, and the an example of what this author has said that the effect of the Catholic Church having this power is that they stop progress for various reasons, whatever reasons they might have. They say, well, you know, there was a papal bull called the no petroleum or petroleum.
Let's see.
I can't remember what it was. Something in Latin that says, you know, no
petroleum. Petroleum veto.
There it is. Petroleum
1910.
Veto. Right. So in England, which the whole book takes place in England, there is these steam engines that run on roads. And that's an actual thing. And the Wikipedia entry actually has a picture. They call them traction engines. And anyway, so it's not unlike a train. He's got, you know, cars in the back, and he drives this steam engine, you know, around the country, you know, not too quickly, you know, 20 miles an hour and stuff. But anyway, that's his job is, you know, he started this business where, you know, well, his dad actually did. But anyway, so I guess my point is, you know, like the Lady Margaret, which is the first story. And then there's a second story called The Signaler. And then mm-hmm. there's a third story called The White Boat. All three of those stories are really about people just living in England in this alternate universe, in this alternate world. And then you've got the second three stories, which are Brother John, Lords and Ladies, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, Corfagate, or is it Corf?
That's how I think of it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those three stories are more of a direct confrontation with the Catholic Church, I would say.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, and again, the Catholic Church of this book.
Oh, yeah, right. Definitely.
And then,
but it's a direct extension of his ideas that are kind of mentioned more slightly in the first three stories,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is that it is all powerful.
Yes, yeah, definitely all powerful.
Yeah,
and then so you know, Brother John is about this monk who ends up turning against the church. Lords and Ladies it has the guy who from the first story, the Lady Margaret, in it. I thought that was kind of cool. He was the uncle.
It's his niece, right?
Yeah.
Telling the story.
Right. And then the last story is actually about a rebellion that's, you know, you get the feeling that this is the beginning of the end for the Catholic Church in that story.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the white boat comes right before that, because the white boat shows a tiny touch of what's going on below the surface
mm-hmm.
that we've seen in these stories, where there yeah. are... Well, I don't know how much we want to say about that at this point.
That's okay. You know, an interesting thing to note is the white boat is the third measure in my book. And
oh,
I've noticed,
really?
Yeah, and I've noticed in other story, in other ones that the Wikipedia entry says the white boat is not in all editions. And oh. an edition that I had showed it as number 5. Is that where you have it?
Mm-hmm.
It's the fifth measure in your book.
It's right before Corfag Gate. Yeah.
I don't know why they've moved it around or taken it out or what. I don't know the story, but in my copy, it is the third.
Because in mine, it makes sense, because it shows the reasons why the rebellion would be starting, in a sense. It shows some of the ways that people are breaking loose under the radar of okay. the Catholic Church's stranglehold on technology.
Gotcha, yeah.
Okay. Through some smugglers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right. Okay, and then the very last thing in the book is called the coda, and we'll talk about that in detail, but it's like a little cap at the end. I'm pretty sure that's a musical term as well.
I think it just means
the end or something.
Ending. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Must, right.
And considering I did go, when I started this book, and look up Pavan, and there were various different definitions, but they all agreed it was some sort of stylistic dance. But the thing that I found most interesting, and I should have written it down, in one of the definitions, it said, within these strict forms, people could introduce their own variations at certain points of them before they came back to the group.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, that's a nice little touch for what he's kind of doing with these people here.
Yeah, sure. Sure is.
Within the very strict form of the dance, they can have a little innovation.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what he was thinking of, but.
Right, right.
That would have been a nice forward to
help us. So, I don't know if we've described the novel properly enough, but my three favorite stories were The Lady Margaret, The Signaler, and Brother John. Try to give like a flavor of what they're like, I guess.
I would say don't come to this book looking for, you know, a fast-driving, action-filled story.
Sure. Yep, I agree with that.
The language is... He is a beautiful writer. It's very poetic in places. And I did not, as I mentioned, love this book as much as you did. I kind of felt about it... I really struggled with a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But as I kept going, the stories either did more or I got more used to his style.
Mm-hmm.
So I really enjoyed the last story and the coda the most of all, because they were the most direct and had the most going on. And when I was thinking maybe I just don't like poetically styled writers. And what it did make me think of is how, in order to get through The Lord of the Rings, I had to listen to the audio because it would deal with things I didn't care about once it got to book two more.
Mm-hmm.
And the language would change and get more poetic sometimes, and a lot more descriptions. And I started to wonder if I would have done better to have listened to the audio as an introduction.
Yeah, and I've got the audiobook as well. And I've listened to pieces of it, and I do like it very much. It's got a really good reader. I should look his name up. But it's a Neil Gaiman selection.
I saw that.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool. And Neil Gaiman does an introduction to it himself. And it's not a really detailed introduction. He just talks about how much he loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's hoping that he was going to publish another Keith Roberts novel under his, imprint, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Narrated by Stephen Crossley, who's very,
okay.
very good. He mentioned that the narrator even knew a lot of the places that this takes place, and that kind of enhanced it for him.
I was looking through a lot of the Amazon reviews at one point when I was struggling with it. I was like, let me look through some of these really super positive ones and see what people loved about it. unfortunately, some of what people loved about it were, yeah, telling it the way it is about the Catholic Church. And I was like, oh, that's not really true, but okay. But okay, you're making me hate it. But one of the things that kept getting mentioned was that Neil Gaiman liked it and that his imprint was what had gotten them to read it. And I do like what he's done with that. I guess it's Audible who's just kind of said, here, you can have your essentially a book club and get things done. Because he's exposed people to a lot of authors they wouldn't have heard otherwise.
You bet. So here on Audible, it looks like he did publish another Keith Roberts novel called Anita, A-N-I-T-A.
Okay.
And it looks like it's about a witch. Book I know nothing about.
Yeah. When I was describing it, I was only halfway through, but when I was describing it to both my husband and to our priest, they both said the same thing. And I think this might be part of my problem with it, which is not a problem with the author. It's just me. They both went, sounds like Moby Dick in a way, because one of the things that I struggled with was the fact that he spends a lot of time describing engineering style things. He describes the engine, and then he comes back to the engine again and describes it some more, and then he describes driving it. Woohoo! And I actually really liked that first story. Mm-hmm. But by the time we get to the second story, which I also liked, I was kind of like, I don't care about signaling that much.
I was fascinated by it. I thought it was something else,
And, you know, Moby Dick, as Rose mentioned when she was struggling through it, which she read the whole thing, she's like, I now know more about 16th century whaling than anybody should.
Right in the middle of Moby Dick, there's, huge. It's like 100 pages long about whales.
And so I suddenly went, okay, this is also just something that is difficult for me, because he does it in such poetic, beautiful language that it's hard to pick out what you need to skip and what you don't, which would be my other way of doing it, is just kind of skim over it and go, oh, here's the essence of the thing and move on. You have to read the whole thing. And I was like, man, you're harshing my buzz. So,
I'll read just a little touch of what you're saying. In the first story, again, the Lady Margaret is the name of the story. And the Lady Margaret is, among other things, it is the name of his engine, or his steam engine, traction engine. So he's stopping. Let's see. Oops, I just lost it. So there's a lot of description about what his job is. Oh, I had a really good paragraph and I just lost it. I've got this Kindle thing and I pressed the button. Okay, there we go. Okay. Jesse recoiled the hose and took the running lamps out of the tender. Four of them, one for each side of the boiler, two for the front axle. He hung them in place, turning the valves over the carbide, lifting the front glasses to sniff for acetylene. The lamps threw clear white fans of light ahead and to each side, making the frost crystals on the road surface sparkle. Jesse moved off again. The cold was bitter. He guessed several degrees of frost already, and then it goes on. I guess that's not as detailed. Cold could stun a man, freeze him on the footplate till his fire burned low and he lost steam and he hadn't the sense to stoke. It had happened before. More than one haulier had lost his life like that out on the road. I agree. There's a lot of this thing, you know, where he recoiled the hose and took the running lamps. It's a real description of this steam engine that he uses, and it talks about, you know, running this valve and that valve. And I just loved it. I read it, this first story, I was hooked after this first story. I was blown away by this first story.
And I liked the first story a lot, and I didn't mind all that description at that point because it was just part of the story. But by the time I got to the second or third one, I was like, he really gets into all these details about this stuff. And then you think about – and then I stopped and thought about what was happening in each story. Things were happening, and I don't have to have continuous zombie action. I'm just saying. But it helps when you're reading a lot of these stories in a row if there's a little bit more moving along of what's going on. And that was the other thing where I thought, once I realized it was a lot of short stories together, I thought, oh, well, Well, these would also stand out as polished gems, I think, if you came across them in a magazine with all different sorts of fiction, as opposed to a whole bunch in a row, since, like me, you might not care about all the description. But on the other hand, in some of the later stories where it wasn't just about signaling and engines and crazy people gone off to become, you know, crusades because the Inquisition drove them insane. I have a paragraph I'd like to read about that is, to me, just he paints a picture so well. From far off along the Wareham Road came the bumbling of traffic, endless and quiet like the noise of bees, the new midsummer hum. The sun moved in the sky, the shadows of trees swayed and shifted, lengthening. Folk passed, laughing on the path below, red-faced men and children, white-shirted boys, girls in bright, frail dresses. He turned the pages slowly, pausing now and again to worry out an archaic spelling. The noise from the village, the bustling and voices rose and fell and quieted. The tea lawns emptied. Pubs propped open their doors. He seemed poised outside of time. For him, ancient winds blew, ruffling the grass. The noise of old guns mumbled in the hills. And I was there with that guy. I mean, I could feel it. And so that was really, you know, I thought a beautiful example of how well he could write and he could capture me with that. So I don't want to make it sound like the book is just, you know, nothing happening. But there are a lot of descriptions. He really does enjoy painting that scene for you.
And I not only that for me, but I had a very emotional reaction to both the Lady Margaret and the Signaler. The Signaler was, if I had to pick one favorite, the Signaler would be my favorite. And there was a lot of description. So I should explain what a Signaler is. There's no electricity or anything, so you don't have radio to communicate. So there's this, they call them semaphores, big towers with, arms that are moved by a user so that you can flash, you know, code or whatever patterns. I imagine, you know, somebody holding these flags, you know, and doing the letters with the flags like they do in the airports or whatever. And, on the marine area. But anyway, these towers have to be set so that you can see the next tower. So you'd signal and then somebody would receive it and then they'd pass it on. And, the people that run these things are in a guild. They're highly trained, people that are in a guild.
Right.
So it's about the story's about this boy who really wants to become a signaler, and ends up becoming a signaler, and then, you know, it doesn't end well for him. but I was taken from the very first description, which is this beautiful, haunting, poetic view of where he is. And it's almost as if the camera starts to back away and you see this person laying there, you know, bloodied in the snow. And I was completely taken by the description. And then it backs up and goes through his career, how he got there in the first place. And then in the end, I thought it was very emotional too. Very affected by it. Yeah.
Yes, I was very upset by the ending of that story. Oh, wait, sorry.
That's okay. We're in spoiler territory
now. You get
the
idea in the beginning, things aren't going to be that great.
Exactly.
But that I did like that story, and I about halfway through though I kind of started going, I don't care about the signaling as much as this author does.
So and I loved it. I thought it was so cool.
Oh, my husband would have loved it.
I thought it was fantastic. So
My husband would have. I was like, oh, you wouldn't care about the story part, but you would love this part right here. And he goes, I think there was something like that actually.
Yeah.
Maybe not developed to that level, and I loved the concept.
Yeah.
Of how they dealt with having to get these messages because they had them all across Europe.
Right. Yeah, they would have had to. Yeah.
Yeah, later in the book, they make that point that, you know, somebody sent a message to London, and, but they've stopped all the signalers along the way. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter because it also went in the direction where it's flashing to Rome right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, should we go on and talk about things more in depth?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, from here, let's talk about things more in depth. Should we talk specifically about the view of the church in this book? I think that's a good thing to talk about.
Made it really hard for me to. I had to keep fighting through it because with each story, he's reestablishing that. Now I realize because he was setting that up each time, but I was just like, okay.
Here's a quick example. Something that to read in the first story again. He valved water through the preheater. He valved water through the preheater, stoked, valved again. One day, they'd swapped these solid burners for oil-fueled machines. The units had been available for years now, but oil firing was still a theory in limbo, awaiting the papal verdict. Might be a decision next year or the year after, or maybe not at all. The ways of Mother Church, in capitals, were devious, not to be questioned by the herd. That's the kind of thing that goes on. You know, and I did not have a big problem with it. Here's one more. The popes might cavil, jealous of their independence, but Rome herself leaned too heavily on the continent-wide of networks of the semaphore towers to do more than adjure and complain, insofar as such a thing was possible in a hemisphere dominated by the church militant. The guildsmen were free. Again, I was talking about the Signalers Guild. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the church that's described in this book was, to me, not... It's not a Catholic church that I know. And I do think that it is an if this goes on type of a thing where, you know, there were reasons for the Reformation. I mean, the Catholic Church is not free of responsibility for what happened there.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So there were actual reasons. And some of these reasons are described in this book. And if, you know, if the church had been frozen in that spot and did not grow through that period, instead staying in this, you know, whatever, you know, immature period that it was in and did not grow from there, but instead was given, you know, even more fire in their whatever. But I'm just saying that he's taken it to an extreme. You know what I mean? So I guess what I'm saying is the reason that I wasn't offended by any of it is because to me that doesn't exist anyway. You know, that church doesn't exist.
Right. Well, and actually, before I'd read the end of the book, which kind of clarifies some things, I was like, to me, the problem was in this case, the author was showing very little knowledge and very little imagination, I felt, because if he had any historical knowledge of the church, he could have crafted it in such a way that I felt was more likely. Because just reading these stories, and here's where I feel it was a failure on the part of the book. Mm-hmm. I feel like when these stories were collected into a book, he should have gone through and fixed it. You know, so they weren't just stories. The way that what is that book? Leibowitz, the A Canticle for Leibowitz was a short story, and then he expanded it and turned it into a book. Mm-hmm. You know, the Martian Chronicles were written separately, and they didn't have to be in continuity necessarily to go just be put together and be in a book. But this, I feel like. I looked at the story it was telling of the Catholic Church, and unfortunately, the problem I tended to have with it was this is exactly what most people think of the Catholic Church as being, who don't like it.
Sure.
They think exactly that it's a monolith. And so when I was telling our priest about it, and I was about halfway through, he just starts laughing, and he goes, yeah, a lot of people think the church is a monolith instead of being all these very opinionated people who are off doing their own thing within these, you know, guidelines. And he goes, I just wish we had our shit that together. And, which just cracked me up. And he said, also, just from a realistic point of view, you would have had, and again, not knowing the end of the book, but you would have had the church going, whoa, wait, there's profit in that? He goes, the church has never turned away from profit. And we both just started cracking up again. So I just kind of looked at it and said, if this is actually an alternate timeline, I would have liked it to be, okay, start off from Elizabeth, but take a look at what the church has really been like through time. You know, we're seeing only, and I understand that he's just showing us how these people see it. We're not seeing inside the church where there may have been discord in a real situation. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like he was taking a really convenient one-note approach to bounce everything else off of. And after, it really annoyed me because I just felt like you're not, I don't know, I just felt like it was the same super prejudiced look that everybody else has. And I don't mind some of that in a book. Actually, I can just kind of go, oh, okay, that's how they feel. But because each short story brought it back again and again and again, so he could introduce it, I was just like, I'm really getting tired of this. So sure, I personally felt that was, I guess, my problem as a reader, because I was like, we introduced scientific method. Hello. By Elizabethan times, we were doing that. Why are you doing this? And I should say that in the Coda, which is a whole different discussion, I guess, what happens is you find that the church actually had what I think the author thought was a more positive reason for doing this.
Yeah, and we can go ahead and talk about the Coda now, okay, because it kind of changes everything. Again, this is this is a huge spoiler, and the Coda is a bit controversial even among people who love this book.
Oh, yeah. I saw that in the reviews, too.
Yeah, so in a kind of a Lovecraftian end to the book, this Coda is tacked on the end of it. After we see in the last story, the Corfe Gate, we see an actual rebellion starting and actual fighting, against this church, right? And then that story ends, and now you've got this little Coda tacked on the end, which I assume was never published anywhere because it's not a well.
I just figured it was done for the book.
Yeah, I figure it was too. Which makes me wonder, you know, what was he thinking? Did he? Well, I guess we'll describe this and then we can talk about that. But in the book, this guy goes to the ruins of a keep and he gets this letter. And in the letter, it says this: the ways of the church were mysterious, her policies never plain. The popes knew, as we knew, that given electricity, men would be drawn to the atom. That given fission, they would come to fusion. Because once, beyond our time, beyond all memories of men, there was a great civilization. There was a coming, a death, and resurrection, a conquest, a reformation, an armada, and a burning, an Armageddon. There too, in that old world, we were known as the old ones, the fairies, the people of the hills. But our knowledge was not lost. The church knew there was no halting progress, but slowing it even by half a century, giving man time to reach a little higher toward true reason, that was the gift she gave this world, and it was priceless.
But this is, did she oppress? Did she hang and burn? A little, yes. But there was no Belsen, no Buchenwald, no, I don't know how to say this word, Pascandale?
Yeah, I don't know what that even is.
Ask yourself, John, from where came the scientists and the doctors, thinkers, philosophers? How could men have climbed from feudalism to democracy in a generation if Rome had not flooded the world with her prescribed wealth of knowledge? When she saw her empire crumbling, when she knew dominion had ended, she gave back what all thought she had stolen, the knowledge she was keeping in trust, against the time when men could once more use it well. That was her great secret. It was hers and it was ours. Now it is yours. Use it well. Mm-hmm. And I was like, really?
Yeah, I mean, it puts the entire, you know, my first reaction to this was annoyance because it puts the entire book in a completely new light. And you're like, oh, you know, so my first thought was, okay, so the Catholic Church never believed that they had, I mean, the whole religion was made up in a way for halting progress. for oppression and halting progress.
They were willing to take it on the chin for man's greater good.
Right. But the truth of the church,
right?
To me, it was talking as if the truth of the church was not believed by the people that were in the church. The people that were in the upper echelons, you know, it's like when the president is given the papers for Area 51 as soon as he walks in.
Yeah.
You know, well, the same thing, you know, when the Pope becomes the Pope, he's like given, well, you know, this church really isn't true. What we're doing is we are stopping progress.
Well, actually, I didn't feel as if it was negating the church in terms of, you know, Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like it was saying there was this other layer and they felt like they had the right and duty to withhold this particular scientific knowledge.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. You know, when we're reading it again, it says here in this previous civilization, there was a coming and a death and a resurrection. So it does imply the truth of that. Even in this previous civilization, this happened.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I'm not sure, you know, then you've got old ones and fairies and people of the hills.
Well, and the burning and Armageddon. I'm like, mm-hmm. What? Are you talking about they could see the other timeline? Because when in this letter,
mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand he had to say this to tell us about it. But mm-hmm. I'm like, did this guy know what Belsen, Buchenwald, and all those things were? Because I don't think he did, because it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's
so
really...
You're
that's
not going
really,
to describe that to him?
Yeah, that really is something.
Yeah, that's yeah. it. So,
because my impression was this civilization happened a long time ago, and then these fairies, like at the end of the Signaler, there was... When he died, it was like this fairy came and got him, right?
Right.
So it's saying, okay, this is the truth is these old ones and the fairies, not Christianity. And this church was set up just to halt progress. That's how I read it.
Oh, I guess I didn't see it that way.
I don't know.
I guess I saw it that I didn't understand why the old ones, except that they're part fairy,
mm-hmm.
the guy who's reading it. And his father. Well, I guess he's all fairy. But I just felt like they all knew it. They mm-hmm. all could see what was going to happen or what had happened. And so the church had enough hold to clamp down and stop it. And that's why in the white boat, they're smuggling, you know, transistors or whatever it is they have.
Yeah, yeah.
And, or tubes or whatever comes before that. See, again, why I'm not good for this book. I'm like, oh, that's something.
No, it's, you know, yeah. And I think that we've just kind of had a different reaction to it because I think, you know, I was enamored with the rest of it. Even with this anti-church stuff, which I never felt got, it's like the stuff that this author had a problem with the church
mm-hmm.
are things that I would have a problem with the same church. If this church, you know, that we were in today was doing inquisitional type things, I would have a very difficult time being in this church now.
Yeah. Right? And the problem is,
yeah, I'm just saying that those kinds of things that are going on, I'm with these characters in opposition to this church that is set up in this novel.
Right.
And then to come here at the end and then have, it's almost as if, I don't know, this turned everything on its side and I didn't like it as much.
And that's,
I like
I know
it better
the reaction,
without the coda. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I liked it better with the coda.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly I think because the thing that had upset me, I understand these bad things happened in the church,
mm-hmm.
but I also understand, you know, he's giving all these nuances and I get it. These are people's lives. We're just seeing what they see of the church and it's not anything very nice. And he's not there to tell a story about the church, but he's using the church an awful lot for somebody who's not there to tell a story about the church. And so I looked at it and went, I happen to know. The reason everybody talks about the Spanish Inquisition is because the government took over the Inquisition there
mm-hmm.
and made it horrible, whereas the Inquisition was all over the place, and in a lot of places there was no reliable court, and people would ask to have the Catholic Church's Inquisition because they could at least get a fair trial.
Right.
So I know that there was a nuance to it. And I think in this book, what we saw was a lot of nuance for the characters and the equipment, but we never saw a nuance to that flat background. And so when we got to the coda, even though I didn't, I still didn't approve of what he did with the church, for a different reason. I looked at it and went, oh, thank goodness, some other view, mm-hmm. you know, something a little bit more multidimensional or something. And of course, since I didn't like what he did with the church there, I was at first like, oh, okay, they were doing it for everyone's good. And then I went, wait a minute, that's not what the Catholic Church would do either, because what about saving people? And which is kind of what you're saying. I'm like, they're not here to worry about progress. They're here to, so that's another misuse of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I would say that, and part of my, and I get this is just me as a Catholic and not me as, I couldn't divorce myself enough from some of those reviews I saw where they're like, finally, somebody's really talking about the Catholic Church the way they should, you know? And I'm like, yeah. So now you're just feeding into it, despite the fact that we know that's just one surface look at the bad stuff. Like, because add the sex scandal stuff in. Do I like that? No. It's deplorable. It's evil. But is there a lot of good going on? Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So, but what's going to be remembered when a book like this is written? Mm-hmm. Let's throw the sex scandal in there, you know. So there was a lack of dimension, and that's not why he was writing it. I'm not sure exactly, I guess, why he was writing these stories.
Well, I actually think that the world that he created is very interesting.
It is.
You know, and so I think that there may not have been a reason beyond that, other than, you know, he was not a fan of the church, I'm guessing. I really know nothing about the author.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I really like what you had to say about the Inquisition. And one of the things, even today, you know, people that have a certain view of the church say, did you know, that Pope Benedict was in charge of the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith? And that is a direct descendant of the Inquisition, you know? And but yeah, these things that are there when they're used properly and they weren't corrupted by political power, right? Whether it be from outside the church or inside the church.
No, that's where you have to go.
There are reasons, right? There are reasons that it exists. And you know, the central authority of the church is something that a lot of people have a problem with. But, it you know, when you're inside the Catholic Church, it makes perfect sense. You know, I've been in other churches where people sit there and argue about scripture. You know, it means this, it means that, or this, whatever, you know, and if you have a central teaching authority, it kind of puts cohesion to everything.
And even when you say that, people are likely to go, aha, they're telling you what to think about scripture, instead of going, no, you can think whatever you want, but they will keep you from grave error.
Exactly.
They will say, don't take this out of context, because it doesn't mean let's go all go out and cut off our hand if we, you know. It causes us to sin, sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, and then the whole view of scripture of the Catholic Church, which is a separate issue, is something that makes perfect sense, you know?
Yeah.
We like context, we like historical context, we, you know, all these things have great meaning.
Yeah, you don't read the New Testament without the Old Testament, and vice versa.
Exactly.
And it's all, exactly.
Exactly. So, you know, when you go to churches that just argue about, you know, what this means and... it's not something that works for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
But well, yeah, so I like your point about that very much. I mean, these things do still exist in the church. There are still indulgences, you know, there still is, you know, I don't think that they call it an Inquisition or anything like that, but there still is a central authority. These things exist.
I mean, our priest is a canon lawyer.
Yeah.
But the reason they have those courts is so that if you want an annulment to your marriage or something like that, you'll have people be able to tell you. I mean, you know, they'll look at all the rules and go, here you go. Now, are they going to force you to do something? No, you could leave the church. You don't have to stay there, you know. If they decide you can't have your marriage annulled, which is, you know, not that common, I think.
Right.
But they take a lot of things into account that other people might not think about.
Yeah. And you know, I find, you know, on the marriage thing, you look at it, you know, people normally when they come up against that have an immediate aversion to it. It's like, well, I'm going to submit to the authority of these men. That, you know, what does this have to do with anything? But you find that again, it's like confession. It's like these other things that when you actually do them and you go through them, there is some type of a transformation or an enhancement of your experience of Jesus that's not apparent. And sitting here trying to explain these ins and outs of canon law, there's just something about them. It's something about the process of going through an annulment is almost a healing thing for the person. It's just in the same way that a confession is a healing thing for the person, even though actually getting there and going through it is sometimes difficult, and trying to explain that to somebody who's not a Catholic, they just say, well, you know, what does this priest have to say about your sins? You know, it's the same kind of a thing. I'm constantly finding things, depth in these parts of the church that I didn't know existed.
That's beautiful.
Oh, well, thanks. But it's true.
You know? Well, and that, because that's in the best circumstance, which is what we all want, that is how it should be, because the heart of the church is Christ. If the church is Christ's bride, should not she reflect the reason for her being at all? I mean, the church is here to help us get to heaven, and we can't do that without Christ, is what a Catholic would tell you.
Right, right.
And it's what I believe. I mean, because it's not that you can't get to church in some other, or to church. It's not that you can't get to heaven through some other faith, but it's the way our deacon puts it, and maybe I've said it before. He's like, yeah, here's the main dish, and you've got it on the table, but wouldn't you like the whole banquet? Wouldn't you like the delicious appetizers and the cocktails and the dessert? And that's what the church has, because the church is using every resource in every part of your life you'll let them to try to get you there, to make it easier, to help you, as you just said, find Christ, to find Jesus personally.
Yeah. And that's how I describe it to people who come in inquiry too. It's this has everything, you know, this is, you know, everything else, you know, this is what Christ gave us in order to help us.
Yeah.
And we've got all the sacraments that he gave us.
Yeah.
And they're all right here. So,
and I know when I've heard our priest, the canon lawyer, he sits on the diocese board or of inquiry or whatever it's called for annulments. And the way they look at everything they possibly can, and they're always trying to understand people's motivations, their inner thinkings on stuff. I mean, they're not just sitting there and going, well, against these five rules, forget about it. You know, they're trying to be as understanding as we hope Christ would be, you know, when we bring him a problem like this.
Right.
And sometimes they'll tell people things they don't want to hear. But a lot of times, I'm guessing from what you're saying, that's the mirror we need to have held up just in our lives in general, maybe.
Yeah, sometimes it's definitely is. You know, I know annulment is a very difficult thing for people outside the church to look at it, and people that are inside the church who have to go through it. You know, it's not always pleasant. But I don't know. I've found it to be a healing thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I really like your point that a lot of the things that people think were done away with were actually just corrected.
Exactly, yeah.
And now are being used properly.
And so that's actually, sorry. Go ahead. I'm just saying, that's actually how I view the Reformation. I mean, the Reformation was a correction. You know, my dad has said, you know, he was raised Protestant. Lutheran, I believe. And when he started to look at the Catholic Church, he came to the conclusion that the reasons for the Reformation were valid. And two, those reasons no longer exist. So he came into the Catholic Church with that belief. Having looked into it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the Reformation is something that needed to happen to the Catholic Church, in order for it to progress and correct.
I don't think I could go that far. I think having read, and maybe I've just read the wrong histories, but having read a little bit about it, I think what I would say is those reasons, the reasons they it happened were valid, but the Reformation itself went too far, because I really feel like Martin Luther, if he had had the obedience of Francis of Assisi, who reformed the church from within, mm-hmm. of Teresa of Avila, who also helped reform the church from within, but kept trying and kept trying and kept bringing it up, but with obedience, I think he would have been one of the greatest saints. And I think that Reformation would have happened within the church again, but without separating us from people who now we have to go, don't you want the whole banquet? I feel like that, because there was, the church had a lot of grave problems, but they had realized some of it, and he really made them realize it. And so they had sent someone to him as an envoy. And again, I would have to read more into it, and your father may go, well, she's wrong, and he'd be right then, because I didn't look into it that much. But from what I understand, they had sent someone to him going, you know, you're right, we need to work this out. Come back and talk to us. Unfortunately, at the same time, other zealous churchmen were doing things like going 500 gold pieces for the man who brings me his head sort of thing. So, you know, you've got the church is not a monolith and we make a lot of mistakes personally. But I always feel like if he had been a little bit less set on his own way, mm-hmm. that it could have been something that was healing within the church, kind of like a good annulment, you know. And that would have helped him personally also. I mean, I feel a sorrow for him.
Yeah.
And I guess good Lutherans listening will just feel insulted. And that's not what I mean at all. I just look at the potential that there was without all the, I mean, I think of all the bloodshed and the wars and this, I mean, not to say nothing of the separation that exists now and all the denominations. I mean, we can do that within the church. We don't have to go outside of it for that. So,
yeah, and there is plenty of that in the church now, you know.
Yeah, there's room for disagreement and everything else in the church. And so I have to stop short of saying the actual Reformation had to happen outside the church. It definitely had to be reformed, but it had happened time and again within the church.
Right.
So,
yeah, didn't Chesterton write a book? I can't remember what the name of it was, where he kind of went through the periods in the church history where, you know, the church could have been seen to actually, you know, it was going through such turmoil that, you know, it may not have existed anymore. And the Reformation was one of those. I can't remember what the name of the book.
Heresy or Heretics.
It could be. It could be.
Which I have sitting right here.
Yeah, and it kept, you know, it still perseveres, obviously. But yeah, it's not the first time that it happened anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. This description doesn't tell me anything really. So, except what a great writer. We should all read this again.
Right.
So anyway,
it could have been the everlasting man.
Oh, I thought that was about Jesus.
Yeah.
Although I guess he could have talked about all that stuff too. I don't know.
Well, if anybody out there knows, Kurt Jester probably knows.
Oh, yeah. Some of our commenters.
Yeah. Anyway, read G.K. Well, Chesterton. He's good.
I know. You should read something by him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so part of the coda was, it did leave me with certain questions that I don't know where criticism of the coda, but I did stop and go, does the end justify the means? Because I think what you're told in the real church is no. And it also left me wondering, I mean, this church in this book, what about free will? Of course, there's no fairies in the real world either, so I don't know how they influenced anything.
Yeah.
But
also, but this whole, I think that I have a natural aversion to the whole, you know, conspiracy theory of history.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that may have been fed my problem with it too. It's like, you know, well, there's all these secret societies that are actually running things, and, you know, you set up the church as the ultimate secret society running things.
Yeah.
And I just have an aversion to that.
And I guess what this book does do, if you could say, is show you the problem with that sort of thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you have all these priests and everybody set into motion on, you just follow these rules. No room for thinking about things, or that was what drove Brother John crazy, you know.
I think that's the problem with most conspiracies is, you know, there's just way too many things that are unpredictable. You know, I would like to see you have 10 people that don't talk, much less, you know, 100 or 1,000.
The Catholic hierarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And every pope that's brought in and all the, you know, because look how different the last three popes have been.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Benedict, John Paul, and Francis. I mean, just like, you think Francis will put up with that for 2 seconds? Of course, in this universe, he would have possibly known about it and mm-hmm. had to not talk. Well, my other problem, and again, I realize we're heaping this on the guy, but I really would love to know what he was thinking, because my other two problems were to climb from feudalism to democracy in 30 years. I find it hard to believe that could happen smoothly without a lot of upheaval and unrest within a society.
Mm-hmm.
And is it enough to keep man from acting in his true nature to give you an extra few hundred years? Because I feel like people are always going to be out there who are going to misuse the technology. You know, we can have nuclear reactors that do, you know, give us energy, but we've also got the crazy terrorists now mm-hmm. or whoever, who you kind of worry about them getting a hold of an atom bomb.
Yeah, no question.
So, mm-hmm. or whatever the most current term is. Some big blow up thing. And I'm like, yeah. So I feel like that was faulty thinking on the part of the author. I guess he was just, it is a coda. It's the last little flourish, but it did leave me with some logical problems there.
Yeah. I remember the first time I ever read anything by Socrates or Plato, mm-hmm. you know, Plato about Socrates mm-hmm. is, realizing that, you know, what, about 3,000 years ago, they were still thinking the same things through that we are doing now. So, yeah, the thought of an extra half a century giving us enough wisdom to make it through is, that's a tough thought. And it really is a tough thought.
And of all the times to freeze something, you know, I look at all these people and go, they're still thinking exact. And that was my real disconnect with the book, I guess. I would be reading a story and I'd think 1968 or 1970 or 1985 or whatever. And I'd go, what? Nope. There would have been some other kind of progress. Mm-hmm. The clothing would have changed. The language would have changed. Something else would have changed. People don't just sit there and nothing progresses. And I realized he was enamored with this whole idea of let's look at what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, there was so little change of any sort that it was a real disconnect with the fact that it was supposed to be modern times. It did make me want to read The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, which was from about the same time, I think, and also is a seminal alternate history book.
Yeah, I would like to read that too, and I never have. But I was enamored with the world. I thought it was really great. If you took the coda off of this, I would give it 5 stars.
Oh,
I really would. Well. I gave it 4 otherwise, but I loved the language. I loved the world. I thought, you know, what he created here was really something else. And I thought it had a real emotional impact. It did on me anyway.
Wow, I gave it. Yeah, well, it did. It was super depressing, a lot of it, by the way. Everybody.
Yeah, it was. It's beautiful and sad. That's how I would describe it.
Haunting and lyrical.
Hauntings, yeah, exactly.
And
very poetic.
I gave it 2 stars with the coda, which I mostly liked because I was like, oh, some positive something about anything. And although I also really liked the last story. But yeah, without the coda, I would have given it 1. It was just not my book. And gotcha. I know that everybody loves it. So I realize it's a stylistic problem between me and the author. I'm not saying the book is bad. It's just not my book.
Gotcha. All right.
And I think I told you C.S. Lewis wrote some essay about there are some books that reviewers just should not even read, and they certainly shouldn't review them because it's not going to ever appeal to them, no matter how well it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this might be that book from one of those books for me. That's why I stay away from Moby Dick.
All right. Taking Moby Dick off the list.
Well, and I might love Moby Dick as long as I had a print copy so I could just go, oh, more whaling. Flip, 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 flip. Ah, Ishmael, here we are back again. Or
nice.
What a Queequeg or whatever the Indian scene was.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Yes, that would be a much shorter book if I read it. And on the other hand, I know people who can't stand Dickens or who really don't like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which for me are just, oh, they're like feather beds. They're so wonderful. I just sink into them. So I fully understand. And that's why I don't want to condemn the book. It's just not for me.
Yeah. Understand. Understand.
But it did give us some great stuff to talk about.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Interesting stuff.
Yeah. And the way he talked about, again, I had another tiny sentence marked, which was the waves were indifferent and the wind and the rocks neither knew nor cared who owned them. Christ's vicar or an English king.
Yeah.
You know, he just had beautiful little sentences dropped into things that, despite myself, I had to love them.
Yeah.
So.
right.
So I'm glad I read it.
Well, good. I'm glad you read it. Because, it was one that was on my list for a very long time.
Yeah.
So, well, good.
So,
all right. So what is coming up now? This is going to be another good discussion. The next one in the movie, Noah.
Okay.
A biblical movie by an atheist. It'll be fun.
I have about probably 50 pages of reviews and comments and stuff that I printed out and set to one side to look at I watched the movie. So finally I can dust that thing off and pull it out.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun to talk about. I honestly have no clue how you're going to react to it. But I've seen it and I'm eager to talk about it.
Yeah, I don't either. I read a lot of Stephen Greydanus's commentary.
Uh-huh.
As it was leading up to it, because he was an early supporter of the movie and starting with people who were like, it's not like the Bible. And he'd start off going, wait, how do you think of Noah's Ark? Because read the Bible. It's not like animals 2x2 and blah, blah, blah. So I am prepared for that, but I'm interested to see what it's like.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. And I think I said last time that I have my copy of Ashes to Ashes by Emma Lathan. Came in from Paperback Swap, who has more. So
anybody who wants to read along, get yourself a free copy.
Yep, yep. That's paperbackswap.com, by the way. I don't know if everyone knows about that site, but it's wonderful. So go check it out.
Yeah, you only have to put 10 of your books up there to get started, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you just send free books back and forth to each other as you as want them and as they come up.
Yeah.
It's really great.
I just sent a couple out yesterday.
Yep. And I guess then I need to pick a movie.
Yes. Movie time.
I know.
September, it'll be the 25th or so. And then it's October. Yay.
Oh, man. Have you been thinking over the scary stuff?
I am thinking. Yep.
Okay.
You betcha.
No more Keith Roberts. That would be too scary for me.
Oh,
maybe that's
man.
Just a personal thing, like being afraid of spiders or something. I don't know.
You bet. Well, cool.
Well, and my daughter, my oldest daughter and I are going to go visit my mother at the end of October because my mother loves horror movies. Not hardcore ones, I guess, but my daughter also loves them. And the worse, the better, I think I've mentioned. Like Sharknado is a personal love of hers. And Amazon Women of the Cannibal Jungle, one of her favorites.
Oh, and, too good.
Yeah, so I have to connect these two so they can watch scary movies. And I can sit there and kind of just knit in a corner and go, you're going to, Hannah, bump me when a scary scene's coming so I don't watch.
I don't know where I saw it, but I saw maybe 2 minutes of Sharknado. Was it on TV or something?
And
maybe it was just
a sci-fi
preview.
Channel.
Yeah, okay, so it was on TV. So I saw second, that and I was like, I was stunned by it. I thought it was, it's a phenomenon.
That's kind of what I've heard.
Yeah.
It's a thing of its time.
But I think I saw as much as I need to see anyway.
Well, it's one of those things where as much as my daughter loves this stuff, she's never seen Halloween, which I also haven't seen. And my
Halloween's
mom's
actually
like, what?
Very good.
She has her own copy of it.
Halloween is very good. Yeah.
That's what my other daughter was saying.
Every now and then, you know, one of those movies just, I mean, I don't know that it created that whole subgenre of the crazy killer movies, you know, like Friday the 13th and all that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But everything's just a comparison to that one. That one, it was actually very well done.
That's what Rose was saying. She said, mm-hmm. Yeah. And she goes, the great thing about it is Mike Myers is just evil. There's no attempt, like in the redo, I guess, to give him a backstory so you understand. She goes, nope, he was in the insane asylum and he's evil. Done. Right.
And he wears a mask throughout that movie. And do you know who the mask is of?
I don't know.
Do you want me to tell you, or do you want to try to figure it out?
I don't know. Will it enhance my viewing?
No. It's just a cool piece of trivia.
Tell me.
Captain Kirk.
What?
Yeah.
I can't. What? Why?
I don't know that there is a why. It's just Halloween.
You're walking by. Let me make a mask of your face. You look pretty evil or innocuous. One or the other. I'm not sure.
I love it.
Okay. Now I can't really see it. There's a Star Trek connection. Why did no one tell me this earlier?
I love it.
Well, so anyway, mm-hmm. we'll do that. It's like when I watched, was it 21 Days Later?
Oh, wow.
Where I was really dying to watch it. That and Cabin in the Woods.
Really? Oh, yeah. Cabin in the Woods. I remember you saw that. But 21 Days Later, I'm surprised that you watched that.
I was interested, Rose Hannah had to sit with me and go, don't look. Okay.
Now
and
I
then,
get it.
The whole time they're out in this like little place out in the country at some point, just kind of camping out within two walls. And I kept going, oh no, oh no. And she kept going, relax. And I went, no, I don't think so. I think this is just.
This is not okay.
I'm the worst for these kind of movies, but I'm still interested. Funny. That's really the worst.
That's funny.
And I blame Shaun of the Dead. Before then, I had never had any desire to see any of these.
I love it. Yeah. Those zombies move pretty fast in 21 Days Later.
I don't really think that's really a thing. I think real zombies move slowly, mm-hmm. and, we should trust the literature on this. I think there should be a voodoo priest nearby somewhere, possibly killing a black rooster. Don't know. Just saying.
Right. Well, cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for reading this book.
Thank you. It was an experience. Mm-hmm. And, and it's one that will add to my rich history of books, I guess.
You bet. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you to our reviewer.
Yeah.
On iTunes.
Right.
We dropped a review in there.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.